hello, listeners, both alive, dead, undead, and exploring all realms in between. We greet you to this month's spooky Third Foot episode. In the other 11 months of the year, an episode named The Third Foot would be considered bizarre and strange. But in this month, the month when the door to the spirit world is laying open, a third foot is considered nothing but normal. And with me is my own favourite spooky appendage, Barry McStay.
Presumably for this month, it's a cloven third foot.
Yes. Yes, it is.
For non-long time listeners, our third foot episodes are our bonus monthly episodes where, thanks to the kind donors to our show on patreon.com, we go back and look at a topic that maybe we've covered and go a bit deeper into it, or just pick out something we feel like we should have covered in the podcast but maybe haven't. And given that it's a spooky time of year, Ben has picked a suitably spooky topic for us this month.
Yes, I have. I'm going to talk about one of the most iconic authors of spooky literature. We're going to talk about Bram Stoker, but in particular, we're mostly going to talk about Bram Stoker's other 10 novels that aren't Dracula.
Yeah, we did. Is it the Lair of the White Worm? Is that the name of the book that we talked about on World's Worst Horror Story recently?
Yeah, that was my nomination, and it is a truly dreadful piece of shit.
Full of mongoose.
Yeah. Oh, God, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, lots of mongoose.
Full of mongoose. And then in the film version, it stars Hugh Grant, who was clearly warming up for his role in Paddington 2,
yeah.
Starring opposite adorable, tiny, hairy creatures. So I'm not really going to tell you too much about Bram Stoker himself. You can, well, either listen to our old episode on that or look at it elsewhere. But it might be useful for you to know, dear listeners, that he was an Irishman. That he worked as both a civil servant and as an assistant to Sir Henry Irving, Ireland's greatest actor of the day, in the opinion of Sir Henry Irving,
yes.
And some other humans as well. And that, as was the fashion for the time, he was greatly into, well, Gothic literature, obviously, because of Dracula. But there's all sorts of other running themes that pop up in his novels that are so wonderfully fin de siècle. It's end of the century for fans of Blur.
Yeah.
I guess would have made him seem like an extremely modern writer at the time, but there's something sort of charming reading about them now, and you'll see what I mean when I mention them. So his first novel that was published in 1875 is called Bram Stoker's The Primrose Path.
Already at that point he was calling it Bram Stoker's.
No, I'm calling it
Oh,
Bram
fine,
Stoker's,
okay, because I was thinking that's very like, I'm already Werner Herzog.
Yeah. No, I'm Werner Herzog.
That's the only way Werner Herzog gets anything made these days, is just sticking his name on the front of it.
I mean, I'd love to see Werner Herzog's Mulan.
Yeah.
That's just the first thing that came to mind. Werner Herzog's Cars 3.
It makes, genuinely, I feel like there's a parlor game where you just pick movies and stick Werner Herzog's in front of it. Werner Herzog's Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
But of course, how many Werner Herzogs does it take to change a light bulb? First, we must understand why the light bulb wants to change.
Yeah.
Quick little summary of The Primrose Path, because you don't need to read it. Jerry O'Sullivan, ding, ding, ding there for the most Irish name you can come up with there, Bram. Mm. An honest Dublin theatrical carpenter. I'm presuming that is a carpenter who works in the theatre, not a carpenter who just goes, oh my word, I need a 2x4 and a hammer and some nails immediately.
Every time he picks up a saw, has to like play something on it first.
Yeah. I feel like theatrical carpenter would be a good description of Jesus.
Or he does, maybe he does that thing with the, you know, the stabbing between your fingers with the screwdriver, but he's doing spirit fingers and jazz hands while he's doing it.
Spirit fingers is what he gets if he does a direct hit with a screwdriver. Primrose Path. Jerry O'Sullivan moves to London. He seeks a better job. Against the better judgment of the people surrounding him, he decides to head to the metropolis with his faithful wife, Katie. He's hired as head carpenter in a squalid theatre in London, but after several misfortunes, he is strongly tempted by and eventually brought down by alcohol. Unjustly, suspecting his wife of infidelity, he murders her with a hammer and then cuts his throat with a chisel.
Unjustly. I like that you have to clarify that.
Yes, it was an unjust murder-suicide.
Yeah.
So that was his first stab.
Doesn't seem like there's much development there.
No, well, from the reading that I did, character development doesn't seem to be one of Bram Stoker's great skills. Like, even in Dracula, a lot of people say that they are well-fleshed-out two-dimensional archetypes much of the time.
Yeah.
His style can come across as a little clunky through the ages.
Yeah.
His second novel, 5 years later, is Bram Stoker's The Snake's Pass. And it centres on the legend of St. Patrick defeating the King of Snakes in Ireland. I didn't realise that that's how St. Patrick succeeded, that essentially, like Sonic, he had to take out the Dr. Robotnik of snakes, and then the rest of them went, well, he's defeated our king, we'd best be off out of here.
Yeah, that's right, in some sort of Royal Rumble cage match situation, I'm imagining.
Bless you, Barry, you have just identified your complete lack of understanding of the wrestling world.
I know, yes.
How much we've talked about it on this podcast, you should know. There has never, to my knowledge, been a cage match Royal Rumble. And if it was a Royal Rumble that St. Patrick was involved in, surely he would be flinging 29 other creatures out of Ireland,
yeah, that's
along
very
with
fair.
The snakes.
That's very true.
I just like the idea of Sir Patrick going, get out of here, snakes. And you, the wombat. That's... You too, the echidna. Get out of here. Oh, an elephant. Okay.
We don't have any moles in Ireland. Maybe they got flung out in the... one of them had a worm in its mouth. Patrick thought it was a snake.
Very possibly. Who hasn't looked at a mole in their life and thought, oh, that's a little furry shot put just asking for it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It centres on the legend around that, but the novel also centres on the troubled romance between the main character and local peasant girl.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a word that I had not known before, but you might be able to tell me. Do you know what a gombeen is?
Yeah, it's an idiot. Particularly, like, if someone's playing up their countryness. I mean, used a lot in politics, and I'm saying people are being like a gombeen man to be like playing up their countryside, non-city boyness to make themselves seem like more of a man of the people, but also just it's a general sort of fool.
Oh, right, because as an ear, so the love story is the young woman in it, her father had lost his land to a gombeen man, so her dad must be a double idiot if he's lost his money to a provincial moneylender. And there's these two parallel plot lines of the love story and a race to find a lost treasure connected to St. Patrick. Where's the treasure hidden? In a shifting bog. So, again, Stoker is really sort of playing up his Irish credentials here. We've got two more novels before he finally thunks out the classic that is Dracula.
It's a shame that he doesn't go full Irish for it, like Dracula as well, and make him from like Galway or something, as opposed to Transylvania.
What would an Irish vampire be like?
Here, boy, I want to suck your blood. Here, go on, let me have a go on your neck, will you?
Yeah. Well, of course, surely what he's got to do is like suck 3/4 of the blood and then let it settle within his system.
Yeah, it just leaves
and then
the head.
Top it up. Yeah, it just leaves the head. Perfect. 5 years after The Snake's Pass, he wrote Bram Stoker's The Watter's Moo. The Watter's Moo. I think it's short for The Water's Mouth,
okay.
But it's spelt M-O-U apostrophe, and so I'm taking it as The Watter's Moo,
okay.
I'd love to tell you, was about a manatee. But all I can tell you is that it's the story of a woman who is in love with a man whose job it is to stop smuggling by poor fishermen like her father. Ooh, the conflict.
Mm.
Then, in the same year, he released the Bram Stoker's The Shoulder of Shasta. Another romance novel, because before he wrote Dracula, he was pretty much just like not a bodice-ripping romance novelist, but clearly that's where he thought his heart lay. This book is set in the American West. I have nothing really to tell you about it, apart from the names of four of the main characters. Essie Elstree, fine. Mrs. Elstree, her mother, fine. The family guide, called Grizzly Dick. And Essie's governess called Miss Gimp.
Oh dear. That's the one thing you don't want to do with a gimp, is miss it.
Just different times. Different times.
It's like he's been writing about Ireland for his entire career, and then he goes, now, what are the names like in the rest of the world? I don't really know. Let's have a stab at American
yes.
names.
Oh dear, I've made a horrible mistake.
Grizzly Dick.
Yeah. Following the tale of Grizzly Dick, he did get onto onto Bram Stoker's Dracula, written by Bram Stoker. And then a year after that, there was Miss Betty, a novel of which I can find... Sorry, Bram Stoker's Miss Betty.
Of course.
A novel of which I can find literally no record, nothing other than it's another romance novel. So clearly he wrote Dracula, was like, oh, that was a bit of a misstep by me. Back on the romance. Mm. 1902, you've got Bram Stoker's The Mystery of the Sea, which is apparently quite good.
Okay.
It's got... that's like a political thriller. Tells the story of an Englishman living in Aberdeenshire who falls in love with an American heiress. It brings in... it's set during the Spanish-American War. There's a plot involving second sight and kidnapping and secret codes, mm-hmm. which is great. A year later, you have Bram Stoker's The Jewel of the Seven Stars. Now, this... is a first-person narrative, and it's all set around the world of Egypt and Egyptology. There's a plot to revive Queen Terra, an ancient Egyptian mummy, and it explores all sorts of brilliant themes like imperialism, the rise of the new women, societal progress, and I think he may have been writing that in answer to a novel called The Beetle. Have you heard of The Beetle?
No.
Its full title, The Beetle, A Mystery, was a horror novel written by Richard Marsh, and it was released in 1897. Why, Barry, do you think you should have heard of The Beetle?
Was it the inspiration for something much more famous?
No, it was, in 1897, the year that Dracula was first published, the best-selling novel in the United Kingdom. It outsold Dracula by 6 times to 1.
Wow.
And although there were some good reviews of Dracula at the time, the Manchester Guardian at the time described it as an artistic mistake to fill a whole volume with horrors. A touch of the mysterious, the terrible, or the supernatural is infinitely more effective and credible.
Mm-hmm.
2 stars. The Beetle sounds great, though. There is a problem that there is a character from the Orient who brings message of a strange curse, and he is known solely as the Arab.
Sure.
But once we get over that, here's the plot summary of this. I should give it its full title, not Bram Stoker's The Beetle. And it is in it, an ancient Egyptian evil known as the Beetle arrives in London to wreak mysterious vengeance on a politician named Paul Lessingham. This strange creature that is born neither of God nor of man orchestrates the disappearance of his fiancée, and it becomes a race against time to solve the mystery of the Beetle and save Marjorie from an unthinkable fate. And it's told from 4 different points of view at the same time. So it's told from the point of view of Robert Holt, a clerk who's hypnotized into becoming a mindless slave, Sidney Atherton, a cynical inventor of murderous weapons of war, and the clever detective, August Champnell. So it's, and I presume Lessingham as well, but it sounds really good fun.
August Champnell is a good detective name.
Yeah, really, really good.
It's got the same cadence as Hercule Poirot.
I was about to say, yeah. I think it might have been his answer to that that he wrote. Then he took a couple of years off, and he came out with a book called The Man. Now, this is quite complicated, and I'm not going to go into it, otherwise I'll just be retelling the plot for the next half an hour. Yes, so this starts off with a chap called Stephen Norman, who is Lord of the Manor in a place called Normanstead, and he marries a lady called Margaret Rowley. They have a baby girl, and shortly after, Margaret dies tragically. And Norman promises her that he will love their daughter as much as he would have loved a son. And so Margaret asks him to name the little girl Stephen. And the novel is all about this young girl with a boy's name. And sometimes she lives as a tomboy. Sometimes I think she fully cross-dresses. And it's all about sort of her life story. Living this strange double life and trying to find acceptance and trying to find love. Childishly... two of the people she's involved with romantically, one's called Harold and one's called Leonard. And there's something about a woman pretending to be a man called Stephen, falling for another man called Leonard, that just smacks of Blackadder Goes Forth.
Yeah.
I just fit in my mind, I can't get the image of Bob out of my head. I feel like, geez, that Bob. But it's, I don't know how good or bad it is as a novel, but in terms of the subject matter, it seems very modern, doesn't
yeah,
it? And
yeah.
And published in 1905, kind of ahead of its time as well, when you consider, you know, the real booming of tomboyish women was in the 1920s.
Yeah. Shame she wasn't a vampire, though, wasn't it?
It is a real shame. It is a real shame.
He didn't have enough vampires in it. That's what all of his publishers would have been saying. Oh, it'd be great if there were just a few more vampires in this.
Just one or two. Yeah. Just one or two more vampires.
What about Dracula 2?
Yeah. Well, you say that, but his great-grandson had a pop at writing Dracula 2.
Sure he did.
Yeah, we got nothing else going on.
Yeah.
He wrote this next in 1908. He wrote Bram Stoker's Lady Atheline, which, again, I don't really have to tell you much about it. Again, all around the notions of the new woman, which is quite interesting. That the plot is neither here nor there, but he seemed very interesting in unpacking these notions of liberated womanhood, which mm-hmm. I think is pretty progressive of him. And then just before, in 1911, he published Bram Stoker's The Lair of the White Worm. 2 years before that, in 1909, he published Bram Stoker's The Lady of the Shroud. Now, that's another epistolary novel, like Dracula, narrated via letters and diary entries. Mm. And this is all about a black sheep of a family, a chap called Rupert. Real Brewster's Millions vibes about it.
Okay.
So, a chap called Rupert St. Ledger inherits his uncle's estate worth £1,000,000 on the condition that he live for a year in his uncle's castle in the land of the Blue Mountains. Ooh. I say Brewster's Millions, it's a bit House on Haunted Hill as well,
yeah,
isn't
it? Yeah, I never get why you would sign up to any will conditions like that. You'd be like, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And you go, why? I'll just have the million. He's dead, he won't know. What's it make a difference to him?
Well, the whole point of the book is that he will know, because you'll be haunted.
Oh.
So yeah, so there's a haunting in that. So the ones I was most interested in were the early ones, because there's just this notion of him being this we think of Bram Stoker, I guess, as being a bit like H.P. Lovecraft, but a lot less racist and homophobic.
Yeah.
But Lovecraft is an unfair comparison. Of Poe is this Poe is obviously this great tragic figure, and it feels like the life he led fed into all the stories he wrote, and also that I've in my mind Edgar Allan Poe's life, he lives in one of his stories.
Mm.
But Bram Stoker, he just wanted to be loved and to tell love stories.
Yeah, bless him.
Yeah, I found out a few interesting facts about Dracula as well. It would be remiss of me not to to do this. Do you know what supposedly caused the nightmare that inspired him to write Dracula?
Did he eat too much garlic?
Oh, it would be great, wouldn't it? He ate some bad crabs.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, steak was going to be my second choice, so...
Yeah, real solid.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Real solid.
Real shame. He missed an open goal there.
Yeah.
He had a bad coffin fit.
Yeah, I refuse to engage in this.
Blood oranges.
If you carry on like this, when I have to transcribe it, I bet there's going to be a few typos. You come for the king, you better...
I don't want to be negative about this, Ben. Happy Halloween, everyone! And you're all feeling scared now. Anyway, go on, what else?
And you're editing this week, so I can't get rid of any of this nonsense.
Yeah, this is all staying in.
Yeah. Do you know what the name Dracula means?
Vlad Dracul is the Romanian thing. Is it meant to be Impaler? Is it related to Impaler?
No. So the whole thing about him being inspired by Vlad the Impaler is... It's not a misnomer. It might be true, but Dracula is Romanian for the devil, or son of the devil.
Oh, cool.
And when he decided to write the book, it took him, and this is a lovely lesson to all aspiring writers, he researched it, and particularly Carpathian folklore, for 7 years. And, you know, Dracula is such a common, so common now, but at the time it was not at all common knowledge. And when he went to a particular library to read about it, the word was so rare that the library didn't advertise that they owned a book with it in. The only way to gain access to that book was to ask for it specifically, and it could only be handled with the librarian's supervision. And I like to hope it was chained to the shelf and was down in the basement, down amongst the cobwebs.
Because it was such a little known but also evil word that if someone was coming looking for it, they needed to keep an eye on them.
I think so. It was either that, or it just came from a particularly rare book that they didn't want nicked.
Yeah.
Couple of last things. First of all, do you know about what the first performance of Bram Stoker's Dracula was, or when it was?
was it one of those, like, we're going to get loads of famous writers around to read Dracula together?
Oh, I mean, the end bit, you're not far off. But no, it was performed on the stage.
Okay.
And it was performed 8 days before the novel was released.
Oh, cool. Did he get Henry Irving to do it?
Well, we'll bring Henry Irving in a minute. So since you mentioned him, Henry Irving, who, of course, was an English stage actor, but he worked at the Lyceum Theatre, and he is widely acknowledged to be the inspiration for Count Dracula, and he had this very haughty, disdainful manner, and he would play members of his company and backroom staff off against each other, and Bram Stoker certainly at first doted on him and thought he was absolutely wonderful. Whether by the time he turned him into a blood-sucking vampire, he still felt the same. Mm. Tricky to know.
Yeah.
But we'll come to his involvement in it in a moment. So the reason that it was put on is A, because he wanted to copyright the reading of the script so that it could be submitted to the Lord Chamberlain's office for approval, so he could retain the dramatic rights. It was sort of meant to be, I think, a publicity stunt for the book, but it also seems quite cobbled together because the play was only advertised half an hour before the performance began, and there were only 2 paying customers who showed up to watch it.
And, he needed a better agent, did Bram?
Yeah, he clearly did. How long do you think the play was?
Oh, like 12 minutes or 15 hours. It's going to be one or the other.
6 hours.
Oh, God.
A prologue and 5 acts. He was able to get Edith Craig, who is a well-known actress and pioneering suffragette, to play Mina Murray. He asked Henry Irving to act alongside her as the Count, but he reportedly refused and said that the script and the book were dreadful.
I guess that's his review of his characterization then.
I wonder whether he read it and, well, how can I put it? Whether he read the novel Dracula and it held up a mirror to himself and he was like, well, I don't see any reflection here. So,
bravo.
Thank you. I was trying to formulate that joke in my head and my brain was going, I'm going to give you all the components, but you may not be able to turn them into a satisfying dish.
Yeah, it's an IKEA joke there, listeners. Just, you know, it's been delivered to you in various pieces. You put it together to make the most satisfactory version of it.
Yeah, precisely. One final thing about Stoker's death. He passed away on April the 20th, 1912, and he was cremated, and his ashes can be found, well, nearby where you and me used to live. They are still at Golders Green Crematorium.
Yeah.
But again, you need an escort if you're going to see them because, strangely, they are afraid of them being vandalised.
They're already ashes. How do you vandalise them?
I was about to say, well, listeners, if you've got any ideas of how best to vandalise some ashes, do let us know. How would you like your ashes to be vandalised?
Send that on a postcard to P.O. Box 666.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, one way to vandalise ashes is to get some Pritt stick and scatter them on a postcard and send them to a podcast. That would be quite inappropriate. Can you imagine if we get a postcard with someone having glued their granddad's ashes and then in 666?
Oh, God. The problem is, knowing our listenership, one of them will do that.
One of them will do that. One of them will be like, Grandad, just walk towards this raging furnace, please. Why? I have to prove a point to 2 men I've not met.
Yeah. Oh dear.
But there's a little, just a little sprinkling of worst foot forward spirit in what happened with the ashes. His son's ashes were also placed in the urn, and it was intended that his wife's ashes would be placed in there as well, but somebody made a mistake and just scattered them in the Garden of Rest. So I feel like his and his son's souls, or their ashes, are sort of looking out of the urn going, Mom, Mom.
Aww.
She's just spread liberally around the garden.
Oh, that's quite sad.
Yeah. So there you go. That's all of the odds and sods that I found about the creator of the world's most famous vampire and, indeed, one of the world's most unsuccessful romantic novelists.
Yes. He really was, like, the Chesney Hawkes of his day, wasn't he? One-hit wonder. That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was kind of tempted to do an episode on famous literary one-hit wonders like J.D. Salinger, Sylvia Plath, in terms of she only wrote one novel, things like that. But I thought it'd be interesting to go down. Harper Lee. Yes, she has definitely only written one novel because the follow-up is the Indiana Jones 4 of American literature.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, as ever, to our Patreon donors who help support this episode and support the podcast in general. If you want to get involved, like many people have done on there, visit patreon.com/worstfootforward, where you can find out all of the rewards and the tiers we offer them at as well.
Yes, indeed. We have had a very pleasing stream of new sign-ups over the past 4 to 6 weeks, and we are now just 3 patrons away from hitting our new target. Oh, golly gosh. And when we hit 60 donors, I believe that our next plan is to put on another treasure hunt.
Yeah, I think that's next one. We did a walking tour / scavenger hunt around London earlier on in lockdown. So if we get a few more donors on Patreon, we'll organise another one in a city. Maybe we'll do Dublin, Bram Stoker's birth, or Newcastle, or I don't know, somewhere like Paris or Sydney. Somewhere interesting. We'll pick somewhere where there's a nice walk, famous things to look at, and good fun things to find on Google Street View for you to all try and find.
I'm torn. Let us know what you fancy for that, listeners, because fingers crossed we'll hopefully hit that goal relatively soon, and we'll make it like a nice Christmas treat. And I'm torn as to whether we should do, you know, places where we're from, or since it's Christmas, maybe do Bethlehem, or just do somewhere where we've never ever been before, like pick Astana or Santiago and just have you, me and a bunch of listeners getting lost around the virtual streets.
Yeah. Steph, if there are any international tourist boards who want to have a chat with us about that, feel free. Meanwhile, you can also find the podcast on the usual places. If you're listening to us now and you haven't hit subscribe, well, do that. You can also find us on Twitter, on @worstfoot. Ben's on @BenVandeveld. I'm on @BazMaxDay. And we're also on Facebook, if you look at Worst Foot Forward. Our website is worstfootforwardpodcast.com. And you can email us at worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you want to get in touch with us at length.
Those are all excellent pieces of admin for you to do immediately. I don't know about you, Barry, but I'm off to enjoy watching something on my plasma TV.
I hope it doesn't suck. Thanks for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Boo, boo, boo.